You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Chris Rogers. I work with the Regional Policy Initiative on Afghanistan and Pakistan here at Open Society Foundations. With the elections in Afghanistan, ongoing armed conflict and peace talks in Pakistan, I think we're entering a truly pivotal period in the region, which is, I think, why a book like Abu Bakr's, which I think challenges many of our assumptions about the nature of the conflict, Pashtuns, and the Taliban in the region, is coming at a really critical time. And so we're very glad and happy to have him, as well as Amna Nawaz, here to discuss today. Abu Bakr Siddiq is an internationally recognized journalist with Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, based in Prague, specializing in the coverage of Afghanistan and Pakistan. He researches and writes on security, political, humanitarian, and cultural issues in the region and the Pashtun heartland where he was born. He is the author, of course, of the newly published book, The Pashtun Question. Amna Nawaz is an Emmy Award-winning NBC correspondent and bureau chief for NBC News in Pakistan. She previously reported for NBC's investigative unit covering the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. raid on the Osama bin Laden compound in Pakistan. She's reported for NBC throughout the world, including Syria, Turkey, Colombia, South Africa, and Haiti. Nawaz has also reported extensively from the conflict-affected areas of Pakistan on U.S. drone strikes and militancy, including recent exclusive reporting from North Waziristan. So we're going to start with Abu Bakr offering a couple opening remarks on his book, particularly in the contemporary context of politics and conflict in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Then Amna will pose a couple questions and have a bit of a discussion and dialogue between the two of them. And then we will open it up to the audience for questions. And look forward to a great discussion. Thank you very much.
Well, Chris, thank you. I must thank the Open Society Foundations for hosting me, Chris Rogers in particular, Rachel Reed, and Javed Razai. And I'm also grateful that Amna is moderating me. I hope she won't ask me too many difficult questions. We are both journalists and we know the tricks. I'll first give you a bit of a background story on why I wrote the book. I was born and I've lived in Waziristan and raised in Waziristan. In Waziristan, we have a saying which in our particular accent of Pashto says, Kagar chagdai pasariel yarshta, which means that even the highest mountains have a path over them. So this whole Afghanistan-Pakistan thing, something that I've been writing about, trying to understand now for nearly 15, 20 years, is a very complex issue. And what was lacking was that there were not too many indigenous perspectives. There were all angles from Washington, from London, from Islamabad, from somewhere else, covering these issues, but not what people thought there, what is essentially the reality. We're still, I mean, about the Pashtuns, the last good book that people still cite and is, I think, being recommended in campuses was written by Sir Olf Karo, the governor of Northwest Frontier, and the book was published in 1958. The society has changed. Afghanistan and Pakistan and this region has been through tremendous changes. And we still see the Pashtuns essentially through those lenses. As growing up as a schoolboy in Waziristan, what I saw essentially was a lot of suffering, particularly of the Afghan refugees who had fled their homeland, Soviet occupation. And I was exposed to two very contradictory perspectives or narratives. One was from Radio Kabul, which said invasion is a great thing, the Soviets are a friend, they're here to develop us, they are bringing development and prosperity and all that. The other narrative was in the mosques, in the schools, in daytime, which said that an infidel power has occupied a Muslim country and we must fight them and there must be a jihad and people we are hosting here are all muhajirin, the refugees, and the mujahideen will be ultimately victorious. Now, between these two narratives over the past 30 years, the Pashtuns have been the main, or 40 years, have been the main victims. Their institutions have been destroyed. Whatever political evolution they did over the past centuries, it was kind of, in so many ways, undone. And I wanted to find good answers to all these questions. I wanted to understand what the being Pashtun means in 21st century, what the Pashtun society is like today, what does a tribe means, how the tribe related and all that. But I also wanted to understand, and that is a lot in the book, the current militant networks operating, the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, the political relations between two very important states in modern age, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And also the key thing that I have tried to bring out is how integrated these societies are. Afghanistan and Pakistan are two, in many ways, hostile neighbors. But the society in both countries is extremely integrated. There are hardly two neighboring countries anywhere else in the world that are so integrated in terms of the society. And what integrates them, what integrates the society is, of course, the Pashtun people, who now are around 50 million in both countries. In Afghanistan, they're nearly the majority or the largest group. In Pakistan, they're the second largest group. I would not go into the details of the intricacies of the tribal society and the Pashtun political problems in Pakistan, what is happening in Afghanistan, different regions of Afghanistan. That's all in the book, and I hope you read it. I would like kind of focus today's talk more on what is happening now in Afghanistan and Pakistan and what is the way forward. In Pakistan, essentially, we have these so-called peace talks with the Taliban. And by talking to a lot of senior politicians recently, I was told that the peace talks are nothing more than Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's effort to appease the Taliban, essentially, and the strategy is to protect himself, his family, his business interests, and the eastern Punjab province, which is his main political base, from Taliban attacks. The military is apparently not happy. There is a lot going on between the military and Nawaz Sharif. Some of it is coming out into the news. So in Pakistan, these are kind of in near term as a major threats. The Taliban talks, as far as I can see, will not succeed because there are no basis for them to succeed. The Taliban, the state cannot simply give away part of its territory to a non-state actor, a people organized as essentially in alliance with international terrorism. In Afghanistan, the prospect, because of the elections, look more positive, and more optimistic. Everybody in this room, I hope, saw the television pictures of people queuing in lines for hours to cast their ballots on April 5th. But we also have to remember that democracy is not an event. Democracy is a process. And that process takes a long time to take root and kind of get into this unique mold of, like, for example, if we have Indian democracy, we have a Pakistani democracy, we are seeing now the evolution and strengthening of the Afghan democracy. The key steps there, of course, that Afghanistan, the political elite now have to accept the results, or if there is a runoff, of course, it will create a lot of disagreements, a lot of divisions, but still they need to somehow come out of it as a unified nation. One of the things that I hope when you read my book you realize that I have discounted all these stereotypes about Afghans being bitterly divided along ethnic lines and all that. The reality of the society is very complicated. I'll give you one small example. Since 9/11, particularly in this country, the media has told us that Afghans are essentially these four major ethnic groups, the Tajiks, the Hazaras, the Pashtuns, and the Uzbeks, and they are all at loggerheads. They're fighting each other. But when you go to Afghan society and you live in them, there is a lot of assimilation. A lot of Pashto speaker Afghans have adopted Dari. Most Afghans are bilingual to go with, but a lot of Pashto speaking Afghans have adopted Dari as their native language, their first language. They still retain the Pashtunness. So there is no basis for this kind of territorial-based ethnic conflict in Afghanistan, as we have seen in other countries. But in Afghanistan, the big thing is that, as far as I can see things, the future Afghan leadership has to sign the BSA, precisely for the reason that Afghan security forces, which now happen to be 250 million, need sustained international funding. And Afghanistan needs to be a state robust enough that can administer its territory and prevent it from being taken over primarily from groups that are based in neighboring countries and get outside support. The last points that I want to make is about the future. In my book, I've gone into length documenting the history of bad relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Pashtun question, what do Pashtun want, what they don't want. In 2014, I can see that we have a reasonably good chance of establishing what I essentially call lasting peace between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this is a process, this is not an event. The process will go like Islamabad, being the more powerful state, has to convince the Afghan elite that Islamabad is not interested in installing governments in Kabul. That Islamabad is a friend of Afghanistan, it's Afghanistan's internal affair. By the way, Islamabad does it with all other neighbors. They've never tried to appoint Ayatollahs in Iran or influence the Chinese Communist Party, and of course they cannot even think about doing so to India. But in Afghanistan, they should not support a group of ruler mullahs called the Taliban, who, by the way, are a genuine Afghan movement, but the thing is that they do not represent the entire spectrum of Afghan population. They do not even represent Pashtuns. They are a very small segment within southern Pashtuns primarily. And the Afghan elite, on their part, Afghanistan also has to recognize that for durable peace, there has to be some kind of a recognized border between the two countries. And the way forward for this is what I have argued is economic integration. The society is incredibly integrated. If you can build on economic integration in one generation or maybe even before that, because the Afghan elite is now very smart, they have learned their lessons, you will have the confidence in both capitals that we can go ahead with this, that the whole Durand Line question will not be that central, it will not be relevant. And frankly, a lot of that has been based on I think perceptions, not realities. In Pakistan, I'll give you one good example. Today, in 2014, despite all the violence being concentrated in Pashtun regions of Pakistan, the tribal areas, Balochistan, parts of Balochistan, and also in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Pashtuns do not have a secessionist movement. The two major Pashtun nationalist parties, the Awami National Party and the Pashtun Familiar Party, are mainstream political parties, and their maximum demands already have been addressed in the 18th amendment that was passed in 2010. So, but at the same time, I've documented this at length, there is a lot of unease among the Pashtuns about this whole phenomenon of extremism, about what they essentially see is their society being controlled or micromanaged through violence and terrorism. And that has to end for a peaceful future.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everyone for coming as well. I hope you won't mind if I just take a few minutes to pose some of my burning questions, having read the book. If you get a chance, if you have any interest in the region at all, which I'm assuming you do if you are here, I strongly encourage you to get it. It is perhaps one of the most comprehensive and detailed looks at a very specific community that we've been talking about for the last decade quite a bit, but very few people have firsthand and long-term experience with. So thank you to Abubakar for drafting this. I think you've done probably one of the most difficult things that any journalist can do, which is try to take a critical look at your own people. And it's sweeping and comprehensive, so I do encourage you to read it when you can. I want to pick up on what is sort of the largest premise, I think, in the book, and the intent that you actually touched on this. It's written in response, in a lot of ways, to the discussion you've seen taking place over the last decade. This idea, the kind of the common assumption that the extremist elements, the militant elements that have taken root in the Pashtun heartland, find their support there, if not tacitly, then overtly in some way, that there's something rooted in Pashtun culture, that they support this movement in some way. And you've actually touched on in the book in several ways over the last 100 years that there have been other forces using or exploiting the Pashtuns in many ways, dating back to the ruler in Kabul using them as a fighting force, and Pakistani government using them as a fighting force in the battle for Kashmir. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why that is. Is there something in Pashtun culture, in their geopolitical location, that allows that to continue to happen?
Well, one of the big points that we have, the Pashtuns are dealing with two states who have been failing or at some point have failed. Afghanistan, for instance, in the 1990s, have failed. So that's one of the biggest things we remember. But also the thing that historically, I mean, since the European invasion of South Asia, Pashtuns have been on the decline, the Pashtun power in South Asia. We should not remember that Pashtuns have been king in India historically. There were dynasties, Pashtun dynasties, that not only ruled India or South Asia, but also Iran and Central Asia. So this is not a secluded tribal society. This is very much people connecting two very important regions, the Central Asia and South Asia. In modern days, we know about the Great Game and how the Pashtun regions were one big part of that arena and what happened and how it shaped modern Afghanistan and how it shaped, for example, about modern Afghanistan. I mean, you take a state that loses a lot of its territory or majority of its territory and majority of its population. How can that state ever be or that nation ever be strong? This is the tragedy with Afghanistan. That's what the Afghan strong, every Afghan feels very strongly. It comes out in movements. For example, I'll give you, I've touched upon it in my book. One part of the communist movement in Afghanistan was that they were also nationalists. They wanted to kind of take the society out of what they saw afflicts it, which is ignorance, illiteracy, backwardness, all that. And they looked to communism and Moscow to help in turning it around. In today's context, this country, a lot of people like quoting polls and figures. There has been an investment of close to $1 trillion, or more than $1 trillion, in the wars basically centered in Pashtun regions. By countries as diverse as Cuba, Czechoslovakia, which no longer exists, by the way. I live in Czech Republic. It's a separate country from Slovakia. And Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Emirate, and you name it, everybody was involved. Which society in the world could have sustained that kind of funding? A few days ago, somebody in Washington asked me that the same question, essentially. Is there something intrinsic in the Pashtun culture that they are violent and all that? And I said, look, in Pakistan, I'll give you one very good example. In Pakistan, one of the most peaceful people, or people who were not associated with violence and were not called the wild tribes, were the people of South Punjab. This is a classic South Asian feudal society where the feudal lord is the lord, really, in literal sense. But now, if you study that region, most of the terrorist recruitment or extremist recruitment, anti-Shia militants, all kinds of them, come from South Punjab. What has changed that? It's the money that somebody's putting there. So in Pashtun case, there's a lot of funding to that end from many sides, and it's still happening, unfortunately, as we speak. Unless you stop that, you break that political economy of conflict, things will not improve. They will. If a father has 5 sons and he cannot feed them, he's going to send them to a madrasa. And if he's lucky, the madrasa will not be violent. I have made very clear in my book, I have not labeled anybody. I have gone into great detail to research who the Ubandis are, how they differ over the way forward. In many cases, some of them want to be peaceful. Some of them see violence as a means of achieving their political objectives. My answer is a resounding no. And one other thing that I want to add to it is, in rural Pashtun settings, particularly in tribal society, violence is very structured. In Waziristan, we have a saying that if you kill somebody, it will bring snow. Snow is a very bad thing in Waziristan, by the way, because mud houses and it can kill you. So you never kill anybody without a good reason. And that kind of what we call, what the British have called badal, this whole notion of revenge killing, is not actually revenge killing. It's a very modern concept of reciprocity. You, being a New Yorker, I'm sure you every day you meet people who do something good for you. And you will do good for them in return. This is called reciprocity. And that's what also happened in Pashtun society. In tribal settings, if there is no hotels, if you cannot go and find a motel in, say, Miransha or something, you will go and visit your friend or your father's friend or somebody whose name you have heard, or you will show up at the village mosque and somebody will give you food. But when somebody from that village comes to your community, he will expect the same. That's why this is. But a lot of people have kind of romanticized these notions. Olf Kero is one good example. The whole British colonial ethnography that went on for more than 150 years, a very good example of that, and still being quoted. People, every second book that I read about Afghanistan quotes the Malakand Field Force, this book written by Churchill when he was a journalist, back in 19th century in Malakand. So modern Pashtuns, my effort was, should not be seen through those eyes.
You talk a lot about the money that's going in, that's gone in through the years, this economy of conflict there. Yeah. But you seem to also argue that the money is what's needed to be able to change the culture. And I'm curious about that in two ways. One is what kind of economic investment you'd like to see, because there are some efforts beginning to be made, at least that I've seen on the Pakistan side, which is just ironic because of the way the money's been flowing from Pakistan in the last decade or so, but less so on the Afghan side. And I wonder what you think the difference in treatment is of Pashtun culture on both sides in terms of economic investment and how that can lead to stability there. And also, if you think that economic investment at this point in time, where we are now, given the relationship between the two countries, given the post-election scenario in Afghanistan and the post-withdrawal of U.S. forces as well, whether this is the right time to do it at all without security and stability.
Well, I've always been, I mean, purely from a very personal perspective, I've always been opposed to this idea that people from outside, particularly the Westerns, should show up in conflict zone and then roll out, hand out aid in terms of, like, giving people wheat or edible oil. And this is not going to change anything. This is going to make people dependent. The Pashtun society or Pashtun economy has three main economic sectors that they engage in. One is trade, the other one is transport, they're very closely related. The third one is agriculture. And all these three need peace. So there has to be a lot of movement on the political side first to establish peace. And when you have peace, the Pashtuns have the resources that they need. Of course, it will take generation. You have to train people. For example, in Swat, we have some of the best trout fish anywhere. Swat grows one of the best peaches everywhere. I'm from, we have the best apples in Pakistan or in that region, in Quetta, in Topavaga, Kakari. You name it, across the border in host, Paktia, Paktika, the same. In Afghanistan, a lot has happened since 2001 with the international investment, but of course, corruption is a very big problem. The capacity of the Afghan government is a very big problem. You won't believe how much money is wasted purely on only guarding these NATO security convoys. How little is actually, for example, if there's $100 million sanctioned for Afghanistan somewhere in the Western capitals, let's say Norway, maybe $100,000 of that is actually of some benefit to Afghans. The rest is all goes into overhead. I mean, this is a very complicated, and it also requires a very good study to pinpoint what is happening. In Pakistan, the Pashtuns have a very big political problem. One big political problem is what we call FATA. Now, FATA is an obsolete structure. It was created by the British as a kind of a no man land between Afghanistan and Pakistan, as this non-conductor, because when we had Pashtun political movements in Pakistan, what is essentially in Pakistan, in Charsada Abdul Ghaffar Khan movement, it could not go through Fada to Afghanistan. We have one of the leading reformist movement anywhere in Islamic societies after Turkey under King Amanullah in 1920s. And Amanullah's reforms didn't seep through Fada to Pashtuns, Eastern Pashtuns, because Fada was this man, no man land, Ilaka Gher, Kabaili Ilaka, whatever. You cannot, these people are not humans, these are tribes, and tribes are therefore subjugated under these laws. In Fada, the law of the land is today called Frontier Crimes Regulation. It's an obsolete law. It establishes a collective punishment. If there is a crime in my tribe's territory, the whole tribe is responsible for that.
But in terms of the economic investment, we're going to get around to the disenfranchisement of people,
economic investment mm-hmm. will make an impact when people are empowered, when they can question.
Politically,
when they have representation, when they have a voice in national mainstream. In Fada, yes, a lot of the money goes, but I mean, how much of that money actually reaches the people? Mm-hmm. What good is it does? No one can. For example, there's a road in South Waziristan. I'll give you one example. The road was built by the military. It's a very good road, the best road, one of the best in Pakistan that you can travel on. But the entire Masood tribe, which is half of the population of Waziristan, is banned from traveling on those road, that road.
Banned
because
by whom?
By the Pakistani state, by the Pakistani government, be that the military, civilian. Every Masood who wants to travel on that road has to get a permit from the political agent or some kind of government authority in South Waziristan 7 days before he travels. People cannot, the Pashtuns are famous for loving their land. They want to at least bury their dead in their graveyards, but that's not been happening. The Masood have now purchased land close to Dar Ismail Khan to bury their dead because they cannot travel to Waziristan because of this law. Mm-hmm. So it looks very good and nice on papers and in newspapers and in television bulletins that we are bringing development and this. But unless you empower the people and you make them, if a Pakistani citizenship means one thing to a person in Waziristan and another thing to a person in Lahore, mm-hmm. there will always be political problems. There will always be unrest. The people will, because humans, after all, are famous for carving out their own survival strategies.
This brings me back to the question on the border that you mentioned earlier, though. If that were to be more firmly maintained and strictly controlled, if the two countries came somehow to some agreement that said this is where we draw the line, if Afghanistan recognizes the Durand Line as the international border, can you still have that kind of investment in the population, or does that just divide and further cause disarray in the Pashtun heartland at least?
Well, the border, can you just repeat?
Of course, you're saying that if they feel more empowered politically,
yeah.
And I'm assuming that means in the central governments on both sides of the border, that's the way to do it, right, without creating their own government.
Yeah.
So if that border was to be maintained and more firmly kept in place and recognized by Afghanistan, you're essentially dividing
I got you.
So how do they become more politically empowered?
Okay, in Pashto we have a term, we have a saying which says that you cannot divide separate water with a stick, because water will go around it. This is the example of the Pashtun society. You cannot have a hard border. You cannot mine and fence the Durand Line and say, forget about Afghanistan, and the people of Peshawar and Waziristan and Quetta should look to Lahore or Islamabad. And let's. And similarly in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, there is fundamental difference. In Pakistan, the Pashtuns are a minority. So they have all these complaints that a lot of other ethnic groups in most developing countries have. This is, a very similar case. In Pakistan, we have a Baluchi insurgency. The Baluch have similar complaints, or perhaps more, they're aggravated complaints. But in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns are a minority. So whoever rules Afghanistan, and there were non-Pashtun rulers in Afghanistan in the past century, they have to, they cannot subjugate the Pashtuns. The Pashtun, they will not, they will still rely on the Pashtuns. Like, for example, in the past 10 years, every time I read Pakistani papers and said in this press conference in Islamabad, people always complained, there is no Pashtun representation, there is no... But when I went to Kabul, I met Afghan officials from Karzai down to, say, in Afghan they call it, Afghanistan they call it a mamur, a clerk. The Pashtuns were a well overwhelming majority. In the parliament today, they are a well overwhelming majority. Among the 11 presidential candidates, and there were 8, 10 were Pashtuns, and even Abdullah claims a Pashtun heritage. And he is a, I mean, he, everybody who thinks he's a Pashtun to me. It's not a racist notion of any kind. So this in Pakistan, the dynamic is very different. So precisely on this thing, I know that the Pakistani government, particularly historically, but also since 2005, 2006, there was a famous meeting between Karzai and Musharraf with Bush in 2006, and the story behind the doors is very bad. They were not talking to each other. Bush was being a very good host, but even he could not persuade them to smile and shake hands and all that. And the reason was that Musharraf wanted to, Musharraf's proposal was to fence the border line, the Durand line. Mm-hmm. Now you tell me, if there are people who are intended on doing bad things, who want to blow up planes, who have attacked this city, who have attacked London, do you think that 3 meters of barbed wire will stop them, or a couple mines will stop them who want to blow themselves up? This is not the answer to extremism. So the best will be, yes, border management is another thing. There has to be that, but there has to be overall improvement and confidence. Afghanistan has no intention of ever conquering Pakistan. Today's Afghanistan, today's Afghan leadership. Pakistan should also give up on the hopes that they will be the main like power brokers in Afghanistan. Whoever rules Afghanistan, they can be friends, and this through more the model of economic integration I have outlined. The two countries can exist, the Pakistani Pashtuns can be good Pakistani citizens with all their rights, and they can and they have contributed to national development. Your famous cricket player is a Pashtun. Great politicians, great poets, even in Urdu language, some of the best poets have been Pashtuns. So in Afghan and Pashtuns, the key point is the Pashtuns of Pakistan, if they are more integrated to Pakistan, they will make this bridge to be good friends with Afghanistan, because there is no difference. If somebody in Islamabad can go and represent Pakistan, as some of Pakistan's ambassadors have recently done, in Pashto and Dari to Afghans, there's nothing like that. That's a good basis for friendship.
In the post-election context in the region, in Afghanistan, it seems there was a time in the relations between the two countries when the hostility and the tension seemed to sort of go underground for a bit, though everyone was kind of knew it was there. In recent months, that certainly started to tick back up a bit. You're starting to see a lot more aggressive language between the two countries. And I'm wondering what you think will happen if someone like Ashraf Ghani or someone is elected, someone who has a much more firm idea about the role that Pakistan has played in supporting terrorism, supporting militancy, whatever those ideas are. But if those tensions are to peak again, what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on the Pashtun community?
Well, we have to go back in history a bit. In 1992, the people who essentially took over Kabul, there was no peaceful transfer of power after the fall of the communist government, drove in their Japanese SUVs from Peshawar. So these were the people who had lived in Pakistan, been essentially Pakistani friends or whatever you call them, for a very long time. But once in Kabul, they had to look after their national interests. And that national interest said that we have to have Indian presence, we have to have relations with India, for instance. And that during that time, you'll be surprised to know that Kabul sanctioned all these counselors that Pakistan later on was very angry about. So in a similar scenario, whoever comes to power in Kabul, I can assure you that Karzai has done his best to kind of take this path of friendship with Pakistan. because unlike the past Afghan leaders who had no exposure to Pakistan, this is a leadership who knows what goes on in Pakistan. Karzai speaks Urdu. He reads every Pakistani paper or knows about every Pakistani paper. A lot of his people in the government, or most of the people in the government, have lived in Pakistan, and 60% of today's Afghanistan's population has this experience of living as a refugee in Afghanistan. This can be a great basis for this friendship between the two countries, not hostility. I think with Ashraf Ghani or Abdullah Abdullah, they will take the same line. The problem in Afghanistan is that the Durand Line issue is a very sensitive issue. No Afghan from any community, regardless of they are Pashtuns or Tajiks or Uzbeks, cannot publicly stand up and say, I'm going to sign the Durand Line tomorrow with Islamabad. The only way they can do that is through a process. First, you have to do the confidence building. You have to integrate the economies. The Afghans have to feel that Pakistanis are not going to send any armed groups or create new armed groups to conquer our country, and that Pakistan respects Afghanistan's sovereignty. And Pakistan, in return, has to know that Afghans are not going to let their soil being used against us, against Islamabad. And I think it's Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah both have been part of the system. They will not change the policies radically. They know where the problem is, and they will do their best to kind of develop this new friendship with, they can easily say, maybe at leadership level, the chemistry will work better between Ashraf Ghani or Abdullah Abdullah and Nawaz Sharif. And that is something positive. But on the fundamental issues, they cannot leave the line. They cannot come up with any radical solution. Abdullah cannot, or Ashraf Ghani cannot dream up and come up with a new approach.
But there's a bit of there's a short-term and a long-term discussion in all of this, right? That these are things that will happen over a very long time. Once the confidence is built, once the infrastructure is there, then those changes can be made. But without those changes being made, it's almost as if those earlier changes can't happen. You can't have confidence without allowing people to participate in the political structure, and you can't have the political structure without having the line drawn. But that's a separate point. On the economic investment side as well, it's also a short-term and long-term discussion, isn't it? Because there are some investments being made, but on a day-to-day basis, if individuals are making more, as many of them are, by picking up arms and joining in whatever fight is going on, they'll continue to do that. If they make more by leaving Waziristan and going to Karachi or economically migrating to other places and have no economic investment or reason to stay home, then they'll continue to do that. So what is the immediate sort of thing that you'd like to see happen that you think can start to keep the young men in Waziristan, can start to give them a reason to not join whatever jihad is taking place?
Well, in case of like all human society, when they evolve and there's a problem and people try to find an answer to that problem, they take time. It's natural. It's how societies work. It's what we are, essentially. There's no, in this country or any country, there is no one issue or problem that's resolved like this by somebody saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do today, and this will solve our problem. In our case, our problems are centuries old. So I hope they will not take centuries to resolve. They will take years, months and years. So the first, the best thing is, for example, I'll give you one example as a journalist. For example, if Pakistani media today sends 10 good journalists to cover Afghanistan, and there can be Pakistani correspondents in Mazar and Herat and Badakhshan and Paktia, Khost, and they can report good news stories, and they can tell people in Lahore and in Karachi that all Afghans are, for example, not Taliban. In Afghanistan, women are going to school. There is a lot of normal life going on, and this is what is happening. This is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Similarly, for Afghan media to do the same thing about Pakistan, that's also a positive thing. On the government level, I have advocated, and it's not a secret, that a lot of the bilateral relationship, you cannot get it right without Washington's involvement. And I'm bailed out, but a lot of people in Washington, Ambassador Crocker was discussant when we did the launch, and he completely agreed with this point that yes, unless there is greater Western engagement, at very senior level and consistent engagement. You cannot walk away from Afghanistan again. There will be this impetus, this force behind this process.
This is the last question I'll ask, and I promise to open it up to everyone else in the room. On the long-term approach, because some of the investment that's being made on the eastern side of the border, at least, is being done by the Pakistan military, the building of the road you mentioned, and some markets, small business support, commanders on the ground there use the kind of language that indicates that they will be there for a very long time. They talk about the next generation of investment and change. They talk about a militancy that will take 20 to 25 years to bring under control and have a stable region. I wonder what you think of that.
I don't necessarily agree with that point of view, because Pakistan, it's not a problem in Waziristan or whatever. Pakistan has a larger problem, and let's admit it frankly and honestly, that problem is the military's dominant political role. We had four dictatorships, and when they're not dictatorship, the military is still in charge somehow. That's what a lot of my Pakistani friends inform people like you tell me. That has to change in Pakistan. I mean, you can't have a democracy where there is no civilian supremacy. There has to be civilian supremacy.
But assuming
supremacy.
That will not change anytime
will not change, a prolonged
presence.
I mean, one bad Fatah. Scenario is, I don't want to be very pessimistic, but in Fatah, of course, in Fatah, a lot of the Fatah population, I'm not talking about urban people who are educated and have exposure and can read papers and all. A common man who has never been to a school will tell you that this is all just a game, and we are the victims. It's all just a show to kill us, to force us to leave our region, to end our way of life. This is, in the audience, I know there are people from tribal areas, they will bail me out on this right here, and they'll tell you that this is absolutely true. What is, for example, Parachinar, one of the main towns in tribal areas, it's a predominantly Shia town. The population is religiously, they subscribe to the Shia sect of Islam. There are 500,000 residents there, and they have been blockaded for nearly 4 years. Mostly people who were either from Waziristan or associated with the militant networks in Waziristan. Now, historically, there has never been a war between the tribes of Koram and the tribes of Waziristan. Why? Because they don't cross their paths. Koram is closely linked to Kohat, Waziristan is linked to Banu and Miransh and Dera Ismail Khan. So the Wazirs or the Masids never invaded Koram. Similarly, the Turis never invaded Waziristan. So why and where did the sectarian problem begin in Pakistan? Is it, just natural, or is basically rooted in South Waziristan? No, the first time there were these kind of sectarian riots in Koram were in United India, with something happened in Lucknow. So in today's age, this is also true, that Waziristan and the rest of the tribal region, Fatah as a whole, and the Pashtun region will follow whatever happens in Islamabad, what way the country is moving. If you have a country where there's democracy thriving and politicians are in charge, and these are good politicians, they're clean politicians. I hope someday we will get politicians in Pakistan that are acceptable to powers to be in Pakistan who are credible enough. So I think I see change. On Fatah, I'm very optimistic about one thing, that most political parties have now agreed on the need for integrating Fatah. There is something called Fatah Reforms Committee, and they are a coalition of all political parties, right, left, religious, secular, who think that it's a good idea, and this is the popular idea in Fatah itself, that we need to be integrated into Pakistan. We should be as similar to citizens in Islamabad, in Lahore. We should not be seen as through these kind of colonial lens of these people who do not want to development. I'll give you one other example. The society in Fatah is very integrated to Pakistan. If you go to Islamabad, in every street you will find a house who is a retired bureaucrat from Fatah or some businessman from Fatah. Why they live in Islamabad? Why they don't live in Khyber or Koram? because they want to be modern citizens. They want to send their children to good schools in Islamabad, and that's only possible in Islamabad. It's not possible in Koram or Waziristan or Wanaur or Aurangzeb. And they want to get a good health access, and they don't want to fight. They're sick and tired of carrying a gun every day. They don't want their next generation to be like that. I hope soon enough people get that point. I'm sure that there are many counter, I mean, in military terms, they purely think in terms of insurgency and counterinsurgency and how to control territory and how to manage territory. Mm-hmm. But on a larger political level, and this is again, it's not to the colonel or major or brigadier serving in Waziristan, it's up to the military's leadership and the political leadership of Pakistan, that they need to come up with a good plan and show leadership.
I'm taking all that to mean that you think prolonged military presence there is a bad idea.
Prolonged military presence might prolong the conflict, simply because you have then one side of the conflict, and then I mean, Pakistani state needs to show to the people of Fatah that it cares about them.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And with that, I'll open it up to the room.
My name is John Kushia, affiliated. I wanted to ask you a question about Abdul. He's associated with the Northern Alliance, and the Pashtuns were traditionally rulers of Pakistan. Do you think that the Pashtuns will accept him as their ruler? Or maybe if he has an alliance with Rasul, maybe that would make him more acceptable?
Well, the first thing is that Abdullah's father was, I mean, back in Shah's time when Afghanistan was a monarchy, was a senator, and he's from Kandahar. Most of Afghanistan elite is traditionally, I mean, they have a Kandahari heritage. The Muhammadzai is a clan of Durranis, which is a predominant Pashtun tribal confederation in southern Afghanistan. So Abdullah, if he becomes a president, through an election that's seen as credible, he will be accepted as president. Afghanistan has moved on. We have seen in this election one of the good things about Afghan elections, that we have had cross-party and cross-ethnic alliances. You had a Pashtun leading, but with an Uzbek deputy in case of Ashraf Ghani, and a Hazara deputy, or sometime a Tajik leading with Pashtun deputy, like in case Abdullah is, I mean, by his Pashtun heritage, but because he's been close to Shura Nazar, or this, what outsiders called predominantly Tajik alliance. But you also have to remember that Jamiat-e-Islami party had very strong links to southern Afghanistan. Jamiat-e-Islami was predominantly ethnic Tajik under Rabbani leadership, Masood being the most prominent military commander of that group. But in southern Afghanistan, they had very prominent presence. Mullah Nakibullah. Mullah Nakibullah was once one of the most powerful commanders in southern Afghanistan. He's the guy who took over Kandahar from Taliban. He was so respected. And he was, all his life, he was loyal to Jamiat. I happened to watch a lot of Afghan TV as well as Pakistani TV, and I was very happy to see that in Kandahar, Abdullah has one of the largest political rallies. Literally, at least, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people. They were not like in thousands. So he has been to places like Paktika, he's been to places like Paktia and Khos. So in Afghanistan, this whole, I'm very critical of this view of seeing Afghans as people divided. Afghanistan is not a people divided. Afghanistan is a people united.
So, Hamid Hussein, thank you very much for the book. I'm almost three-fourths through that, and an excellent work that there is. I wanted to put your view is, obviously the both states, Pakistan and Afghanistan, are in a very transitional, I don't want to use the word fragile that year. So outside input is very important, whether economic or political or military engagement that appears. I don't know whether you have seen in the last 12 months that there is, both in the West and in America, is Afghanistan is, or even that AFPAC region is going way and down in terms of priorities, both in the economic or military investment that there. And my feeling is it's actually most of the people are thinking, and we cannot ignore it there because of the threat of extremism, both international and local that there. My fear is that most people which are thinking, which is a more cost-effective approach, is the plan B that there, which is to work on a smaller scale that there, only to neutralize the extremist threat that there from that area, because we already spent so much of money and blood and treasure in 10 years there, and there's not much to show progress in that area. In fact, things have gone worse. All the instability has crossed the Durin line, and that area is unstable, which was not 10 years ago that there. So a lot of people, both the military and the diplomatic, are thinking on the lines where we find the local allies on both sides of the Durin line there who agree with our plan there. The purpose is to contain the threat in that area that there. So with this background, is what you think with your kind of experience and expertise on both sides of the Durin line that there? Because that next phase of conflict would be isolated again to that, the Pashtun land that there. So if the, because these are the powers which is not in the hands of the Pashtuns that day, whether it's in Islamabad or in London or Washington that day, how you feel if this approach is come from the outside that day, how it's going to further destabilize the region that day, and especially the impact on both states, Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, what I know, and by talking to officials, I don't think that there is any U.S. government or any Western government policy to go actively after individual actors, I mean, quote-unquote warlords, and make them. And there is this, of course, there is a lot of diplomatic engagement that goes on a lot of the time, and I'm not an official. I don't have an insider view on what the policy might be, but as far as we can see, I mean, clearly, I mean, Obama's AFPAC strategy and the diplomatic component of them strongly emphasized on stability, strongly emphasized on improving the bilateral relationship. The thing is that, I mean, as long as you, there can be no micromanagement by outsiders of that region, that will ultimately lead to disasters. The Soviet tried to do it, somebody else wanted to do it. And in many cases, like, for example, some of the militias that were created, that's not going to work. Cross-border proxy wars, both if Pakistan is supporting someone or Afghanistan is supporting one, and historically both have done it. In the 70s, I mean, you all know about the Taliban being based in Balochistan and stuff, but in the 70s, the Baloch secessionist insurgency wars migrated in mass to southern Afghanistan. The Mari Baloch even fought for the communist regime, the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan in the 1970s against the Mujahideen. So there is this history and all that. I think it will be a huge disaster. Another thing that I want to make a point about is that, look, Afghanistan today is very different. It is a changed place. So be that in Washington or London or Islamabad or Moscow or somewhere, Afghanistan should not be seen through the prism of 1990s. Yes, in 1990s it happened. There was anarchy. There were a lot of domestic factors to it. There was a lot of international. Afghanistan today is not, Afghans are not ready to go that path. Afghan elite is not going. I have seen, I mean, what people may think about, but if you go to Kabul and you meet people from different views, you will see that there is a lot of unanimity of views. I have seen a lot of Persian speakers, Dari speakers on TV talk shows deliberately trying to speak in Pashto, and Pashtuns doing the other ones. So they are not labeled as these extremists, extremist nationalists in some sense. In Afghanistan today, the society has changed. We have millions of kids going to school. We have Afghanistan has better internet connectivity than Pakistan with the 3G and stuff. So I don't think that this whole idea of recreating warlordism will work. And the other thing is that warlords themselves are so keen on transforming their image, they are investing, literally investing millions and millions of trying to create a new image. Dostum, for instance. I mean, who in the world would have thought that Dostum will make a political alliance which, by the way, also means that he has recognized Ashraf Ghani as his leader with Ashraf Ghani. And the same goes for example, the Hazara guy who is with Abdullah. There was a lot of bad blood between these two groups in the 1990s. So Afghanistan is a changed place. If somebody, I don't know, I have no evidence if this is really happening or not happening, but if this is happening, it's not going to work. It will ultimately lead to failure.
Hi, my name is Helen Redman. I'm an independent journalist and I write about Afghanistan. I focus mainly on narcotics, but I'm not going to ask you about opium and poppy because that's a whole other subject in many ways. My question is about Pashtunwali, and I'm wondering, you know, separation of men and women. I'm wondering if over the time, maybe you talk about this in your book, I haven't read yet, has that changed at all in your opinion over the years? And then the second thing is, I don't agree with you about the bilateral strategic agreement. I think it's pure blackmail. It's basically saying to Afghanistan, if you want $40 billion, and it's clear the country needs money, because without that money, the government could collapse, a whole number of things could happen. But basically, it's blackmail in the sense that you get the $40 billion, but the United States has 10 military bases, over 10,000 troops, immunity for the troops, and I'm opposed to that. I want the U.S. out because I believe that that can only prolong a real democratic Afghanistan from emerging. And if the U.S. is out, then that is much easier. What do you think about that? I mean, are you for the 10 military bases? Are you for the night raids that will continue? Are you for all that?
He told you what he thought.
The first one was on the idea of Pashtunwali,
okay,
which is changed over the years, as you've seen it.
Well, I would love to answer the first question first, because I happen to have been trained in anthropology and I've done a lot of stuff on what Pashtunwali. Actually, the Pashtuns hardly use the word Pashtunwali. They call it doing Pashto. This Pashto is our language. You speak Pashto, but you also do Pashto. In reality, what does Pashtunwali mean? Pashtunwali has few ideals. Ideal behavior types, like you should not be, you should be a good host, you should be a good person, you should be honest, you should be truthful, you should say the right thing, you should not be aggressor. And that kind of stuff. The other thing, the other part of, and this is shared with all other societies in our surrounding, with the Baluchis, with the Tajiks, Uzbeks, everybody, all humans essentially have these ideas of good behavior and how one can be a good person. The other part of Pashtunwali is very technical. It is legal. It is something called narh. In pure Pashtun tribal setting, every tribe or clan or region, it changes from region to region, has this particular unwritten legal code which mitigates political disputes, for example, or land disputes. In Waziristan, for instance, there are no land records. So if somebody says, hey, this land is mine, you will go and call up a jirga, which is another institution within Pashtunwali. So I initially discussed this whole idea of the notion of reciprocity and not being revenge killing, which is something that most of the literature will tell you involves Pashtunwali. So Pashtunwali is kind of a complicated thing. It has universal values, but if its application is very local. For example, in Waziristan, if you show up at somebody's door, the tradition is, because they had a lot of livestock, that they will sacrifice a goat for you. But if you do the same in Swat, the chances are you will be offered rice because they grow rice. In Waziristan, for example, if you have this kind, and then it also relates to the state. In Afghanistan, there were Pashtun regions where the state was very strong, the state imposed taxes. Similar in Pakistan, the state imposed, or in India, they imposed taxes. And these parts of Pashtun cultural law became irrelevant. There are no social memories about that. the tribal structure similarly changes. You talked about women. There is no nothing specifically in Pashtun Wali that says, this is local interpretation, but it also is very much related to the absorption or integration with the state. For example, it was a Pashtun king of Afghanistan who was a champion of modernity. He encouraged women education. He encouraged his wife to go public with unveiling Malka Soraya, Amanullah Khan. He sent a lot of people from Paktia region, greater Paktia region, to get education in the West. He wanted to model everything on Ataturk's model. Unfortunately, it didn't work in Afghanistan case. In urban Pashtun settings, for example, in Peshawar, it's almost mandatory for families to send their girls to schools. You'll be surprised that even in regions like Waziristan, there's still thousands of schoolgirls going to schools because there is a community where there is a school. But you cannot expect people to go to a school when there is no school. You cannot expect a community to go send their daughters to schools when they are daily wage earners in a city like Karachi, 1,000 miles from where their home base is. And the second question was about
BSA. BSA. Yes.
Yeah. The BSA, I think I'm nobody to say it's a good idea or bad idea. The Afghans had a Loya Jirga in November, and the Loya Jirga overwhelmingly said, we are for it. All presidential candidates who are running in Afghanistan say, we are for it, we want to get it signed, this is in Afghanistan interest. So I'm just telling you what I've heard from them. In Karzai's case, Karzai also said, and it's on record, that I recognize the fact that it is very good for Afghanistan, it's a good thing. It will help Afghanistan to move forward and all that. But he has these two conditions. He wants the United States to initiate a peace, credible peace process with the Taliban. And all his other objections were addressed. The U.S. forces, after the agreement, are not supposed to raid homes.
Hi, my name is Michael Sold. I have a question about cutting-edge digital technology. So if we could wave a magic wand, knowing that every culture in the world has very entrenched power people that have made a lot of money and that run the country that are going to be against change because that's going to threaten their existence. So given the fact that that's going to happen, and given the fact that the Arab Spring happened about 3 years ago and there was a large vacuum created and it's still not clear what's going to fill the vacuum, if all of the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan could have access to knowledge on the thing that they all carry around with them in their native dialects, what impact over time could that have on the relationships between men and women and the whole society if, with the explosion of massive open online courses and learning and technology, if you could do that, how would that, in your viewpoint, change things? Given the fact that nothing new has to be developed, it's just taking things that already exist and are implemented in selected places and be able, as I said, waving a magic wand, to put them there, and even though there's very few smartphones and not good internet connectivity.
There's very good internet connectivity, which is the interesting thing, but we'll let
the
book address
that.
You
can do a lot of this on feature phones with micro SD chips.
Technology can have any kind of impact in general society there. That.
Well, I think it will have great, but we must remember that we are talking about society where literacy levels are still very low. So you first have to this infrastructure of education, basic education, and then a good professional education, and then creating all these classes of people who can lead the society in different fields. For example, Afghanistan, I feel, still needs a lot of international support and help in just to give an example, in medical schools, in medical education. I happened to visit the medical faculty in Afghanistan, and some of the books they read are still from 1970s. if you are a doctor, and I happen to know a lot of doctors, it's like reading 19th century books about economics in 21st century. so that's a gradual thing. In the past 13 years, media has kind of brought on a revolution. In Afghanistan today, we have 70 channels. Similarly, in Pakistan, we have a lot of channels. But the thing is that as a journalist, I'll tell you one little secret. It's not that the explosion of media is a good thing. It's what people listen and read on that media. If they read the same old propaganda that has been on the state TV for 60 years, nothing's going to change. Things are going to complicate it. But if they're going to get good information, good analysis, insight, good reporting, that's going to make a substantial impact. Mm-hmm. And it will discredit these negative things.
Saying it's the quality of what the information they receive, yes. Not just the general access to it.
Hi, Graciela Del Castillo. I also write about Afghanistan, and I'm very glad that you brought up the economic issue because there's so much confusion about it. For instance, I don't think Afghanistan needs 40 million. You know, the government has estimated that for the next 10 years they will need 120. But putting that aside, I totally agree with you that if you want confidence building measures between Pakistan and Afghanistan, you have to put the two communities working together on something. And I'm not the kind of person that compliments President Bush at all, but one of the ideas he had, which I thought was very good, and I want to see what you think about it, was the idea of the reconstruction opportunity zones between the two countries. And that was, you know, everybody was very excited about it and nothing ever happened. So I want to hear your views about that. Thank you.
Well, essentially, the reconstruction opportunity zones was a good idea, but it was not implemented because of the security concerns. And in Pakistan, the last time I heard about it, there was some idea that, yes, we can have a reconstruction opportunity zone, but not inside Fatah because it's too insecure. We should have it in somewhere else. That obviously would not have benefited the population of Fatah. And that view was also, I'm not completely agree with that part of the American policy thinking or Western policy thinking, is because there was a lot of emphasis on this kind of outlandish economic ideas, but there was no talk of basic political realities. You cannot have establish an industry in a place where there's no taxation, where there's no energy. You need to, if you want to establish a factory, you need electricity first. In a lot of Fatah, there's no electricity, so if you want to build the best industrial park for textile building, there's no cotton cultivation there. So how can you do that? So it must have been something that was local, it could have come up, and for that's why I advocate this kind of political change, and that's very easy to happen. Unless you do that, you will have all kinds of ideas and all kinds of money being spread around and thrown around in the name of developing Fatah or border regions, but nothing will change there.
My name is Farhad Baykar. I'm a journalist. But first of all, as an Afghan, I very much agree with you, and that's kind of hard sometimes to agree with people from the other side of the border when it comes to issues of the mutual interests or common issues. I don't know if I heard this correctly. You said the violence is structured in Pashtun areas or Pashtun societies. But if you said that, as a Pashtun, I would say, in the absence of rule of law, Pashtuns had no other ways but to go to their jergas because that was the only way to mete out justice. If you can see the examples in Afghanistan, a lot of tribes in the rural areas in the eastern and southern provinces, They used to have their jirgas to bring justice for them, but after, in the past few years, there are judges, there are government that they do those kind of things. So I'm not going to go too much into detail. I have not read your book, so maybe you have talked about those issues. But my question is about the Pashtun ethnicity and Pashtun identity. Why there is so much focus on this? I mean, you said it before. the passions of Pakistan are completely different from passions of Afghanistan. There are more similarities between the Pashtuns, Hazaras, Tajiks in Afghanistan, and from my experience, there are more similarities between Pashtuns and the Urdu-speaking people in Pakistan. So first of all, why there is so much focus on this? Is this something that we want to do this, or it was actually an heritage where we got it from the Great Britain, that when their historian came and they just called us braves, they called us, you know, warriors and so on and so forth, while people really would like to carry on with the normal life. And if you think there is a time to have Pashtuns be recognized as Afghans and have Pashtuns be recognized as Pakistanis rather than having a whole big group which they do not have much to share. Thank you.
Well, I think, I mean, you made good points, and you said obviously a lot of this, the things that were based on facts that Pashtuns are like this or whatever. I kind of disagree with a bit of it, because in Afghanistan and Pakistan there is still like, there's nothing like going up and speaking to a Kandahari in Pashto. I mean, it's still, there's a lot of cross-border tribal connections, like the Momand tribe, half of it is in Momand Agency, half of it is in Nangarhar province, and they have, there are people who have homes in both countries. In 1960, there was a member of parliament who was at the same time the member of the Afghan parliament, and in the Pakistani summers, he will go and sit in the Afghan parliament, and he was at the same time the member of the West Pakistan parliament in Lahore. In harsh Afghan winters, he will go to Lahore. So there is all these factors related to that. It's not as simple. But ideally, I mean, what you said, there should be this evolution of Pakistan, the citizen of Pakistan, be from whatever ethnicity, being a Pakistani citizen with full rights and a sense of pride in that identity. And the Afghans being the citizen of, in Afghanistan, there is an evolution, because the Afghan constitution in 1920s said that everybody who lives in Afghanistan is a citizen of Afghan. Afghan historically was only a term used for the Pashtuns. So these developments have come. In Pakistan, I also have to tell you that still the people in Peshawar, Veli, and other parts of Pakhtunkhwa province, when they write their names in government papers, when it comes to what is your ethnicity, they say they have to write Afghan. For the Pashtuns, it's still because of the lingering thing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, with all the ethnic groups in this region, a lot of these are misunderstanding and myths and colonial myths. Like in Pakistan, there are still a lot of colonial myths. There's still this idea of somehow martial race. Mm-hmm. This is a discredited theory used by the British to recruit officers or soldiers for certain regions. So they will say that, for example, this region in Punjab is martial race, this is not. I mean, in modern times, it's just frank racism. So we should go over it, and we should forget about it.
Just building on that point, though, in order to have that kind of political investment, doesn't this identity, the Pashtun identity, then have to give way to a different identity, a Pakistani identity or an Afghan identity?
Well, the thing is that in America, you can be an Hispanic Pashtun, Hispanic American, you can be a Cuban American, you can be an Iranian American, which is a positive thing. Identities are like flowers. The more you have, the better. In Pashtun case, it will not go away, because Pashtuns have survived in the past 500 years, and that's in my book. They have survived a lot of these efforts. In the British times, the speaking, they couldn't ban the speaking of Pashto, but they had banned the propagation of Pashto language. You could not, there was no Pashto in schools. Even in Pakistan, at one point, because of the communist fears and the red color being associated with nationalist feelings, you could not mention red. So in poetry, you will not say in song that I love red roses or something. So despite that kind of oppression, the Pashtun identity has survived. I don't see it going away, because in today's world, people, even migrants, people, the background you come from, they speak Urdu at home, or they have GOTV going on. Mm-hmm. So changing identity will be very difficult. But Pashtuns can be good Pakistani citizens. And that is what all should matter.
Yeah, thank you. I'm an Afghan journalist, and my English is very poor, so I have a question and a small comment.
I'll translate for you.
I'm a fan of your, I've read your articles as well. I'm from southern Afghanistan, Kandahar, and I totally agree with you. No matter what about Lalbar, Pakistani propaganda, say that the Pashtun in Afghanistan are more similar to the other ethnic groups in Afghanistan. I mean, of course, for centuries, we Pashtuns have lived together with Hazaras and Tajiks, but compared to them, like you said, lingually, culturally, we are very close, between Durand line, just like across the border from Kandahar to Chaman. We have the same Azizi tribes there, and we have the same Mormon tribes there. And still, even abroad, in the United States and Europe, we still cannot get together with Pashtun. We can live with them, we can communicate with them. So that's more whatever you said, I totally agree with you. But since I also worked in a propaganda media, but you are very popular journalist that I have been following and reading your articles. As a Pashtun journalist, since Afghanistan and across the border, it's a very tribal area. And how do you deal with the statistics when you write a book? Basically, I mean, I have worked with UNAMA also as a political affairs officer with them. It's all based on political propaganda. Like you said, the percentage of Pashtun people. And one thing which I was a bit disappointed that whatever UNAMA says about the statistics in Afghanistan or other Western news agencies says, that's not true about Pashtun people. We can see most of the Western NATO and American forces are deployed to the south and the east. So that's basically the populated part of the country where all the challenge comes from. I mean, the northern part where other European troops are there, they don't have, I mean, comparing to the south and the east, they don't face that much challenge. So my question is that how do you deal in your book with the statistics, which is really not true, which in media there is a huge misconception about Pashtun people. And on the other hand, I would like to say something. You said that you were...
Is there a question attached to the second part, or would you like to have him answer on statistics?
One small part. You said Pashtuns in Afghanistan today, they feel as a second citizen. It's true. The coaches in Mosul, they cannot go to their graces. Pashtun lost their language as a traditional language of the country. So Pashtun have this feeling of deprivation and power. So I would appreciate it if you could comment on this. Thank you.
Well, the thing is that in modern states, there's always a degree of dissatisfaction and a happiness with the current political system and all that. In Afghanistan, I think with the statistics, I will give you an example. I've not used a lot of statistics. The only statistics I have used is the government, the population figures, how many persons there are in Afghanistan, how many there are in Pakistan. And to me, the most reliable source was what their government and their government agencies said about this. In Afghanistan, I've quoted the CSO, I think SIA organ or something in Dari in Pashto. In Pakistan, I have quoted the Ministry of Population Welfare, I think. And those are statistics in Pakistan. In the national census, they do ask people what is your native language. Mm-hmm. And that's based, and that reflects that how many Pashtuns are there or whatever. So I on the other thing that in Afghanistan, I have felt that there are extremes. There are a lot of Pashtuns who think that what you said, that we have, we are in a disadvantage, we have lost power and all that and all that. But there are others who look at things very differently, who think that if we have peace, it doesn't matter if there are Hazara ministers, if there are Tajik ministers. And I've written a paper about it. I didn't go in length in this book about those issues. But I think essentially these are very small problems, easy to look after. Of course, in modern societies, you have to accommodate. And you have to be, one thing that I've argued for all Pashtuns is to be part of a mainstream. There should not be something that is, they are out of the mainstream and they are these people who are not interested in being part of the states that they live in. I have strongly argued that the Pashtun future is in the mainstream. They are not a people who should try to seclude themselves, who should try to think of themselves as somehow very different, better or worse than other people. They are like other people. They need to have the same rights. In the modern political system in the states, that's what the whole state system is about, and it has worked out well.
Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich. I'm a lawyer and a law practice up the road. I'm also a retired Army reservist, and I spent 2012 in the Kandahar airfield. So I met quite a few Afghans there, and I was very impressed with the people I met. And I'm impressed by the anthropological view, and I have a lot of questions, but too many to ask. So let me try to have one question.
You'll do the honor of being our last question of the evening, so no pressure.
Okay, I have one question in 15 submarks.
No.
One thing that was very sad for me was that of the Afghans I met as a foreign claims commissioner, was one of my jobs there. I was an Army lawyer also. But I would say maybe 10% of the mainly Pashtuns I met could read or write. So it looked like that's a big hurdle for any kind of democratic system. But if the goal is a Republican-style democracy, which I think would be the goal there, the question is what your view is of how optimistic we can be that that can work in a society that's largely tribal. And I will say, I'll give you one anecdotal thing. When I was a foreign claims commissioner.
I'm going to stop you right there. So if there's a question attached to it, please.
Okay, go ahead.
I think there's a lot to cover with the literacy angle. You're asking basically.
It's not really literacy. The question is to what extent we should look at anthropological principles to help, and to what extent we can get a Republican democracy in Afghanistan in light of the tribal nature of a large portion of the country.
Well, I think where I live, close to that, there's a place called Bavaria in Germany, and there were tribes at some point.
And in New York, by the way.
Yeah. So this will take time. It is a process of evolution. And Afghans have clearly shown that they are behind this system. I mean, in this election, they have rejected these notions of being some kind of extremist society and all that. The majority of Afghans want to be democratic. But democracy, as you know, will not survive, I mean, what happens internally in Afghanistan. Whatever has happened in Afghanistan has this huge external influence angle, the Soviet invasion, what happened before that, the bilateral relationship with Pakistan, the civil war, where all the neighboring countries were deeply involved. And even now, today, when you have like militaries of 40 countries in Afghanistan, you have this huge international engagement. And what will happen after this international engagement. So it's not only to the Afghan, it's also, the most important country is, of course, Pakistan, but what the West does, how much it remains engaged. One of the complaints that I've heard from President Karzai a lot is that the moment the Soviet government fell in Afghanistan, this was like the pro-Soviet communist government, most of the Western embassies closed, shut down, and they left. We were the people who were allies, and after our government came into power, we were abandoned. So they don't want to be abandoned again. They want to be very much part of the mainstream. But it's, again, from the international community. And my effort was to give people, a normal reader, I've not tried to make it an academic book. You would bail me out if I'm wrong about it. It's very readable in that sense. So it is to tell a normal person in the West, an English-speaking person, I mean, everybody who can read in English, that, I mean, whatever you have been, all these stereotypes about the Pashtuns are wrong. They are very much ready to be part of the world that you live in. Thank you.
With that, thank you so much for coming.